Hello, welcome. It's 11 o'clock. Welcome to 11th Hour. Again, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off or silence it. Everyone says we should write from experience, and so we do. We write about our friends, our spouses, our parents, our children. Lately, I've been writing a lot about my dog. I didn't even bother to change her name in the manuscript. But let's hope she doesn't care. But what about when they do care? Or we know they will care if they ever read what we're writing. Today, Sarah Safian will discuss the politics of writing about loved ones. Sarah is the author of Ithaca, a memoir about being an adoptee who was found by her birth family. She teaches memoir at Sarah Lawrence and works as a writing coach. Formerly a journalism professor at NYU and the New School, Sarah has written for publications including the New York Times, Smithsonian, and Yoga Journal, and has been a writer in residence at the Atlantic Center for the Arts and the Millay Colony. She is also a therapist and blends her areas of expertise in the therapeutic writing technique, using memoir prompts as a tool for encouraging reflection, processing, and discovery. She received her MFA from Columbia and her LMSW from NYU. Please join me in welcoming Sarah Safian.
Wow, thank you. You can hear me okay? Oh, let me get my water. Today is my mother-in-law's 97th birthday, so I'm honored to give this talk on her birthday, although I've never written about her, but there's still time. And if I do, I hope she would be comfortable with what I say. I can't think of anything other than positive things, but so this speech is in honor of Adele. So I'd like to open with a quote from radio host, well, erstwhile radio host of Prairie Home Companion and author Garrison Keillor. He talks about writers like this. Writers are vacuum cleaners who suck up other people's lives and weave them into stories like a sparrow builds a nest from scraps. People meet writers and are bowled over when the writer is friendly to them and invites them to his house for a glass of wine or to shoot up heroin or whatever they do. And they talk their heads off. And then, a year later, it comes out in a book. And there follow years of bitter and fruitless litigation. And that is why you should always keep a writer at arm's length. And that's all true. So I like this quote sort of as a cautionary tale, but maybe more for your loved ones than for you yourself, the writer. And there are illustrious others like Joan Didion and Janet Malcolm who agree that betrayal sort of falls under authorial license, you know, that art is always the priority and other people's feelings be damned. I'd like to think I take a more nuanced view. I think it's more complicated. And that's not just to be a nice person. I think it's more complicated on a lot of levels, and that's what I'll talk about today. First, I'd love to hear a little bit from who's in the audience. So who here has written a memoir, has completed one? Okay. Lisa. Read Lisa's memoir, Girl Walks Out of a Bar. It's a good one. Who is in the midst of working on a memoir? A lot of people. That makes sense. And who is maybe thinking about it, but maybe scared off by what your loved ones will think? Or if you're in the midst of it, you're worried about that? Yeah. Either as characters or as readers, too, right? Even if you're not basing characters on them, the idea of having your loved ones read whatever you write may give you pause, or both. Well, that's good to know who's here, and that makes a lot of sense, that there are a lot of people grappling with this sticky issue. And do feel free to chime in with questions or comments throughout, because I'd really like to tailor this to whatever particular issues are coming up for you to make it most interesting and useful for you. You know, I make the joke that novelists have it easy, you know, that characters are sprung from the imagination, and they don't talk back when they're not happy with the way they're depicted on the page. But I'd say, are there any fiction writers in here who are grappling with this issue? Yeah, a lot, right. Because Of course, novelists also have loved ones who might be griping about characters either based on them or who they think are based on them. Sometimes they're not right, but they see themselves in the characters and they're not happy with it. So basically, if you're a writer and you also have any personal relationships at all, you're probably struggling with this issue one way or the other, right? Because even fiction doesn't come from thin air. It's not like it's veiled memoir, but nonetheless, whether you meant to or not, your loved ones may well see themselves in your writing. I'm going to quote a lot from Philip Lopate this hour because he has a great book called To Show and to Tell about writing, and he talks about this issue a lot. And one thing he says is, I'm someone who calls himself a writer, and if I write about my life, I am inevitably writing about others, because no man or no person is an island. And so, indeed, it is a challenge for people writing of, you know, in any genre. But more specifically to memoir, what if your character is your ex-husband? Not a composite, but actually your ex-husband, or your twin brother, or your mother. Are familial loyalty and literary integrity necessarily at odds? How can we most effectively navigate this touchy terrain to maintain our real-life relationships without compromising the stories we need and want to tell? In other words, how can we write a memoir that we can stand behind both as the author and as a mother, a brother, a best friend? And one thing I think it comes down to is motivations to write memoir, and we talk about this a lot in my workshop this week. For people working on memoir in particular, if you care to share, what is your motivation? What is compelling you to write this memoir? What is the reason you're doing it, or if you have already? Yeah, Susan. Oh, thanks.
So I need to be able to delve back into some part for the first memoir of my past and examine it. And I don't think any current living people are really populating this memoir, but mm-hmm. even if they were, I'd have these issues that you're talking about.
Right. And you bring up a good point, because sometimes we think, oh, this person is no longer with us, okay, I'm off the hook. Well, again, not necessarily, because your loved ones may be the ones you're most concerned about, maybe your readers who have feelings about that deceased other loved one, and they may not care too much for the way you're depicting that deceased loved one. So we can't really sit around waiting for everyone to die before we write our book. So whether it's readers or characters, it sometimes isn't enough for the person the character's based on to no longer be here, because other people have opinions too. Other motivations to write memoir? Yes. Sorry, I'm making you jump around. Thank you. Or you can speak. Can you project? Okay.
Well, I just like doing it, but I would give anything if a couple of my, like my parents or my grandparents had written a memoir. I would love to know all the stuff I don't know about them. So since I like to write, it just seems like something I ought to do.
And like you would wish for memoirs from them, perhaps younger people in your family might benefit from your story.
Yeah, just to know what happened, and hopefully it'd be entertaining.
Put it down. Yeah, entertain. To entertain your reader is a very good motivation. I'll talk about it in a second. One more over here. Can you project, or Anna can run over? And you showed it to her before it came out?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about that too. Was there still time to make changes to it at the point that you showed it to her, or was it really in the can?
It was really.
Okay.
Yeah.
But she did read it before it was published. Okay, because we'll talk about that too, if and when to share. your work in progress. Great. Thank you so much, Anna, for running around. I mean, pretty much for any genre, I think the motivation to write that's most effective is to tell a good story. And that can be complicated and confused a little bit when we're using our own life experience as our material. There may be lots of other motivations. You know, with fiction, it's somewhat clear-cut. You know, well, I want to tell a good story. To enlighten and entertain your reader. I think that's pretty much a good universal motivation to write anything. In memoir, though, you often see that the motivations are along the lines of to garner sympathy. You know, look at this hard experience I had and feel bad for me or experience it along with me. To seek revenge. Philip Lopate also said, never write to settle scores. Enter into the other person's point of view and be as fair-minded as possible. And it, again, it's not just to be a nice person, but it's actually better storytelling if you're not writing to settle a score, to make a case for yourself. Ranting or preaching are not the same as storytelling, right? And that's hard sometimes when you really want to get a point across, because I've talked a lot this week in my workshop about it's not enough that it happened, but what does it mean? Can you discern the meaning of your experience? And that's really good to identify, but then that can also lead you to wanting to make a certain point. And so that can sometimes come across less as storytelling and more as ranting, preaching, building a case. And that is not the same as storytelling. Another motivation that's less successful from the reader's point of view, perhaps, is to confess, to get something off your chest. Great therapeutically, and like Anna said, I'm a therapist too, so I know the difference, but not perhaps so engaging to another reader, or to process something. Again, very therapeutic. Journal writing does not equal crafted storytelling for other readers. When I do therapeutic writing with my therapy clients, and I have another lecture about the distinction between those two things, they're an audience of one. If they care, that's enough, because it is just for their own personal discovery and processing. If you're writing for craft for other people, the who cares question needs to be asked early and often. I liken it, you know, my workshop this week is probably sick of this analogy, but to a lump of clay on a sculpture. And so the lump of clay is the raw material, whether it's the life experience or even writing it down in your journal. The sculpture is what you craft from that life experience. So you do something to the clay, and you actually leave a lot of the clay out because we all have many memoirs in us. So what is this one about? What is this sculpture as opposed to this other sculpture? In terms of fair-mindedness, I mentioned this yesterday in my workshop too. I'll give you an example from my own experience that I tried to be as fair-minded as possible, but you don't really know if you've succeeded until you get responses from readers. And what was fascinating to me is when I read my Amazon reviews, and some are negative, but negative in a way that reinforced my belief that I told the story fairly, because there was such a range of reaction that, you know, Anna said that my memoir is about being found by my biological family. And some people saw me as the villain, and I kept them at arm's length for 3 years. We just wrote letters before we had our reunion. So I was the bad guy. I was the villain, and they were these loving people reaching out to me. Other people, just as convinced of their opinion, thought that they were the bad guy invading my life. You know, how could they do this? How could they intrude upon me, assume that I'd want a relationship with them, et cetera? I think it's, you know, I don't think anyone is the bad guy. I think the truth is that we're all flawed human beings with needs and desires that were sometimes in conflict. But I was encouraged even by these really black and white polarized responses, because they were so completely opposite from each other, and yet they were responding to the same story. I told one story. And for people to be so certain that their very extreme response was the only correct one, and other people who felt the opposite felt the same way, made me think maybe I did present it fairly. If there's enough of an empty vessel, enough openness for readers to interpret it as they would. You know, I wasn't dictating so much that the reader must respond like this. And I talk about this a lot, too, how as much as we try to communicate our own experiences and our actions, feelings, and thoughts clearly, we don't have complete control over our reader's response. A reader is coming to our work from his or her own personal experience, and it's an interactive experience to read. It's not passive. And that's kind of the good news. That's what makes reading exciting, you know, that I got responses. They saw things in the story that I didn't even expect, and I thought that was very interesting. So good motivations to write memoir, to tell a good story, enlighten and entertain your reader. Sometimes it's because you've recognized a good story and it happens to have occurred in your life. So in other words, you're not compelled to write a memoir because it happened to you, and maybe even in spite of the fact that it happened to you. You know, you may feel a little squeamish about putting yourself out there. You're your own loved one, right? So we're worried about loved ones like people in our lives, but how do you feel about putting yourself through the writing process? How do you feel about putting yourself out there as the narrator and the protagonist? You know, you're exposing yourself. How do you feel about that? But recognizing that it's a good story and that that's the priority. So it's not automatically profound and meaningful to others just because it's profound and meaningful to you. How do you make it enlightening and entertaining to someone else? Philip Lopate again said, writing about one's family or intimates can be an aggressive, vindictive act. Again, not the greatest motivation for memoir, but it can also be a way of communicating something to loved ones you never could before, a gift of the truth of your feelings. It can poison the air, or it can clear it. So that's encouraging to think about, that it doesn't have to be a negative reaction from your loved ones. I'd like to get back to the point that we raised before about if and when to share your manuscript or even thoughts about your creative process with your loved ones while you're working on it. I mean, things to think about are, do I share it at all while I'm still working on it? And if so, at what point will serve both my relationships and my creative process? When would be too soon for me as an artist? When would be too late for me as a person having these relationships? And also, how much what do I mean when I'm sharing my work with my loved ones? How much control do I give them? What is our arrangement? I'm showing it to them, and what am I saying that they can do in response? How do I decide what to change, if anything, to change or leave out entirely? And another thing to consider is determining when something would hurt people and not even advance the story. So it might damage a relationship and also undermine the art. So it's not as though all is better. Sometimes something that would also hurt someone could be a red herring, could be distracting, could make the storytelling less effective. You don't have to share the manuscript at all or talk about it with your loved ones. You can put it out there in the world without doing that. And actually, Philip Lopate recommends that. He says, having made the decision to go ahead and write about someone and having done it to my satisfaction as the artist, I don't want to give that person such power. Once you invite people to make changes on your unpublished manuscript, they will. Besides, it's my moral dilemma, not theirs. Giving them the option to revise would be like shifting the ethical burden onto them. I like that last part. I think that's interesting because that is true, that it is our moral dilemma as artists slash people in these relationships. But I actually don't agree. You know, universally, each situation is different. I can't say there's one right way to do this. To universally, sharing the manuscript gives the loved ones too much power. Because, like I said, you're sharing it and you're giving them what kind of expectation for that? I think sometimes giving them a little bit of power, in other words, seeing it before it's out there in the world, perhaps when there's time to make changes, but not guaranteeing changes. Giving them that kind of power can make them feel more comfortable and maybe in turn make you feel more comfortable. I will give you an example from my experience, and if I write another memoir one day, I may do it differently. You know, so it's not just each particular writer and his or her relationships, but maybe a different point in the relationships, maybe a different work of art will lend itself to different approaches to this. But for my memoir, Ithaca, I was positive that I wanted to share the manuscript with all my loved ones, you know, the sort of main secondary characters in my adoptive family and my birth family and a couple other key characters in the book before it was published. To me, I would have felt uncomfortable if I hadn't done that. But I also really wanted to protect my artistic process. So I worked on it without sharing it or even talking about it for whatever the year or two I was really solidly working on it. So that I could write the book that I wanted to write. You know, they were already breathing down my neck and looking over my shoulder in my head. So I already had this sort of super ego thing going on of like, you know, is dad going to be mad about that? Is so-and-so going to be hurt by that? So I already had that checking system in my head. I didn't also need the actual people to be chiming in. Well, I'm just trying to craft this story. So I kept it really close to the vest for a long time, protecting myself as an artist. And then at the end, when I felt like it was, I felt like it was basically ready to be put out there, but there was still time to make changes. I gave everyone his or her own copy of the manuscript, and I felt like that was probably my least favorite part of the process. I felt very nervous also. I couldn't wait for that part to be over. But it was crucial to me. And I think it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks that they had. So I gave them a deadline, and I said, you know, you can read it, you cannot read it, you can respond, we will talk about it. I did not guarantee that I would make changes. I didn't say, here, take this and take your red pencil and, you know, read it and respond and we'll have a conversation. And I did have conversations with loved ones, which I'll talk about. You know, they had various responses. Some had none, some was a general, it's great, I'm so proud of you. Some had much, much more detailed responses. And I'll give you an example of the kind of control and power I'm talking about that can be helpful. My mom read the manuscript, and she took issue with an incident. She felt uncomfortable being a character in the incident. I don't need to get into the details of the incident, but she felt uncomfortable being in it as a character. And I heard her, and I thought, and she at first said, could you take that out altogether? And I said, well, I can't take the incident out altogether because it's very important to the story, and here's why. So I explained that. And then I said, but you know what? I will take artistic license and rewrite it. It's not crucial that you are participating in the incident. I felt fine about that, and that still falls under nonfiction in my mind because it's protecting the privacy of someone else. And so I did indeed rewrite it with her not in there as a character, and I showed it to her, and she I would have stood behind that as an artist, that version. I felt comfortable with that. She read it, she appreciated that I'd done that, and then she thought about it and said, you know, I think I feel okay about the first version. You could put me back in. So that was fascinating to me because if she hadn't had the opportunity to read and respond to it, she might have reacted very negatively to the incident and being a character in it. But because I had shown her my flexibility, and I didn't feel undermined as an artist at all by the revision, it made her have just enough control, like she felt heard. And so it made her feel more comfortable about the first version. So I thought that was kind of fascinating. So I did restore it, and she was fine with that. Another reason that I think is good to share your work at some point during your process is people don't necessarily respond the way you expect them to. They may not react negatively to what you're worried about, and they may react negatively to things that didn't even occur to you. And especially the former, you know, why censor yourself if it turns out they're not even worried about that thing? You know, you might leave something important out because you're worried it's going to hurt someone's feelings, but if they actually had a chance to read it, maybe they would let you know they were fine with that. As well as you know your loved ones, you can't predict exactly how they're going to react to any individual incident. And Philip Lopate agrees with that. He says, complicating the dilemma is that one does not always know what will cause offense. I have written fairly critically about people who seem to have no problem with it. I have written somewhat negatively about people who ignored the main substance of my critique, but pounced with outrage on some picayune detail they thought I got wrong. I have written glowingly about people who took it amiss. I mean, you really can't win, right? It's just like, come on. Because they did not like the idea of having a walk-on cameo in my center of the universe story when they considered themselves as the center of the universe. Or simply because they did not like the presumption that I could take their measure in a few paragraphs, regardless of how positively I ended up doing so. That's an interesting response. I'm not in your book enough. Like, that's surprising, right? I have given offense to certain people by not writing about them, even when I wrote critically about their colleagues. So I think that that is a really important point. I've heard other writers talk about that too from personal experience, you know, where I expected them to react to this, and they didn't, but they reacted to that. And I have a story of a colleague who I used to teach with in New York, and he's from South Africa, and he lived in New York, and his parents lived in South Africa, and he wrote a memoir, and he was under a tight deadline. He sent them the manuscript to South Africa, and he was waiting and waiting for them to send it back with their responses, and it was getting close to his deadline. So he thought, okay, I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to try to read it as if I were them. I'm going to try to look at it really critically from their point of view and see what they might react to. So he started reading it as they would, and he was crossing things out. And just when he finished doing that, he received their manuscript in the mail, and wouldn't you know it, then nothing overlapped. All the concerns were different. They were concerned about things he didn't think they would be. They were unconcerned about things he thought they would be. And then it's interesting, too, with his, he's written two, that was his first memoir. He's subsequently written two more. And his parents became more comfortable to being, like Philip Lopate says, having their measure taken on the page. You know, so sometimes it's simply a matter of someone feeling uncomfortable seeing them rendered as a character by another person. Like, even if it's not negative, it can make them feel out of control. Even if it feels accurate, it can feel exposing. So that in itself can feel uncomfortable to a loved one. I mean, it wasn't something I had to cut out, but after my Ithaca was published, my mom said she felt uncomfortable when a colleague wished her a happy wedding anniversary. And she was like, how does that person know when my wedding anniversary is? And she said, oh, I read in Ithaca, you know, because I have my parents' wedding in there. And even that, you know, it's a neutral thing. But she felt uncomfortable as a private when her wedding anniversary is. But it was weird that, like, that was the way this colleague found that information out. So just that in itself can make people feel uncomfortable. And again, I think having them read it in advance can demystify just that phenomenon a little bit, like help them start getting used to, okay, I'm this character on the page, you know, and this other person created me, and I can start to feel a little more at ease with that idea. I mean, the two things I mentioned, revising that incident for my mom's sake and then restoring it, so that ended up not being a change at all, and then making some adjustments for my birth father, that might have been pretty much it in terms of changes prompted by their responses. But what I did, because it made me feel comfortable, was before I even started, I asked everyone how they felt about, well, I'm going to write about this, how do you feel about that? And they did give me their blessing. Everybody did. If someone hadn't, I'm not sure how I would have dealt with that. I really felt strongly that I was going to write this, but I would have had a conversation with them about, well, why do you feel uncomfortable with me doing it? So at the beginning of the process and the end, I wanted to include them in that way, but in the middle, keeping my creative process really private. So for me, that felt comfortable. But again, that's not necessarily the way for every artist, for everyone with their different relationships with different people. I'm thinking of someone, now that I think about it, in Ithaca, who, he was an adoption professional. He, you know, I met him a couple times, but he wasn't like a loved one. But I was not going to send him the manuscript. I didn't even know where I would do that. But I changed his name because I went to a support group of his, and I sort of make fun of it in the book. And so I thought, well, let's just change his name. And that's all I did. And part of my publicity was I went to a lot of adoption conferences and stuff. And everyone, he was kind of a well-known person in that community. Everyone knew who he was. Everyone. And I didn't really mind. Like, and I saw him after the book came out, and he congratulated me on it. I don't know if he read it. If he did, I'm sure he recognized himself, but he certainly didn't take issue with it. But everyone said, that's so-and-so. You know, they kind of delighted in that. And I just wanted to, like, again, put a little distance from the real person since I was being sort of snarky about him. But I wasn't that worried about really veiling his identity. But, you know, when I'd see him at these conferences, I was, like, sort of bracing myself, is he going to come over and complain to me? But he didn't. So that was interesting. That's an example of someone who's a little more remote, you know, who I was never going to share it with. But what I did was not, I mean, it was snarky, but it wasn't that bad. And it wasn't private. It was just sort of critical, that's all. Let me see. We only have another minute or so. We talked about multiple truths, transparency with your reader, pseudonyms. I just have another quote to offer you. And then if any last questions come up, feel free. I just want to say as a final thought that take heart that just your being here this morning and being interested in this issue probably shows that you're being thoughtful about this already, you know, that you're being sensitive not just to your writing but also to your relationships with other human beings who may be characters in what you write, maybe readers of what you write, or both. So you're already doing this. You know, you're already taking care. So I wanted to leave you with a quote that's a little gentler than the Garrison Keillor one that I opened with. And it's from Dani Shapiro, but she's quoting yet another writer named Honor Moore, who has written about her own family. And Dani Shapiro, by the way, it's D-A-N-I, Shapiro, she has written very informatively about this issue because she writes memoir too, both loved ones as characters and loved ones as readers. So this is from Dani Shapiro's friend, Honor Moore. We don't choose our stories. Our stories choose us. And if we don't write them, if we ignore them, we are somehow diminished. But at the same time, I don't feel that being a writer gives any of us the right to just let it rip, to disregard the feelings of the people surrounding us. So I take care, perhaps not as much as some people would like, but as much as I can and still not be diminished. And there you have it, the terrible, impossible, fundamental calculus that is at the heart of every memoirist's life. To find your voice is to tell your truth, and there will be a different version of that truth for each and every one of us. So that kind of sums up everything I said. And then Philip Lopate, one last time, offers three quick rules of thumb for memoirists. One, befriend only people who are too poor to hire lawyers to sue you. Right? Two, if you plan to write about friendship, make lots of friends because you are bound to lose a few. And three, for the same reason, try to come from a large family. Okay, thanks so much. Thanks for being here.